This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. Another eventful week in Washington, and it's only Thursday. America backs out of a major international agreement. President Trump and North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un are laying the groundwork for talks and announced this morning that they will meet in Singapore on June the 12th. Investigations into the Russian intervention in the 2016 elections and the Stormy Daniels payoffs merge. Meanwhile, the president's new attorney, Rudy Giuliani, tries to get his facts straight. And the midterm primaries start in earnest. Fortunately, we have political junkie Ken Rudin and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson with us today to make sense of these current issues. Welcome, Howard. Ken?
Well, thank you.
Wait. We're going to make sense of what's going on.
Well,
Dan.
Well, it's asking a lot, I know. But
we're going to give it our best shot.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, before we do that, or try to do that, Ken, I think you probably, I hope you have, a trivia question for us.
Well, I do. It's a bit convoluted, but I kind of like it. but anyway, so Mike DeWine, we know he's running for governor. Now, we also know he's already run for the House and the Senate. So my question is, who was the last person elected governor of Ohio who ran for all three offices? Governor, senator, and the House.
Okay, last person who ran for all three offices.
Not at the same time.
Obviously. All right. So the U.S. House, the United States Senate, and governor. So that's the question.
That's good.
So
yes, but the person had to have been elected governor.
Oh, they had to be elected
House,
governor.
House, senator, governor.
Okay.
Right. No, but he had to have been elected governor.
Right.
Okay. If you think you know the answer, call us at 513-419-7100. Howard is right now trying to figure this out. The person with the right answer will get the coveted Ken Rudin political junkie button to wear proudly to cocktail parties and other places of note. So let's start with international issues right now, especially given the fact that last night at 3 o'clock this morning, three people who had been in prison in North Korea not only were released, but actually came back to the United States. And also today that it was announced that the summit meeting between President Trump and Kim Jong-un will take place on June the 12th in Singapore. And I'm wondering if what this says here is that the president's approach, which has been very hard line towards North Korea, is working. I mean, there's something that's actually working in this situation. What do you think, Ken?
Well, I think you have to say the answer is yes. I mean, first of all, the thought of Donald Trump being mentioned in the same breath as the Nobel Peace Prize when 6 months ago we were talking about nuclear war and who had the bigger bombs and who had the biggest button, and Kim Jong-un was launching nuclear weapons to the west coast of California and, to the west coast of the United States, and Trump was going to respond before that ever happened. And it looked like, World War III. The good news about World War III is that, there won't be a World War IV. So that's the good news about that. But anyway, they were talking about really bellicose stuff. And now we're talking about, first of all, the release of the three Americans, which came at 3 o'clock this morning, and the talking to the regime, which, in all frankness, the Clinton administration, the Bush administration, Obama administration were unable to do. And somehow Trump, whether it's his rhetoric or his impetuousness, whatever it is, it seems to be working.
There's absolutely something that is working that the Trump administration is doing. I mean, it was really striking to me with these three who came back overnight. They appear to be healthy. They appear to be in good shape. They appear to be unharmed. And I can't help but think back, not very long ago when Otto Warmbier, the young man from Cincinnati, was sent back from North Korea in a coma, and he died a few days later. Apparently, he did not get the treatment that these three did. And there has to be a reason for that.
And we don't know what kind of treatment these three had because they were in prison. But
right.
But for all the good things that you can say about Donald Trump throughout this whole negotiation, he said that the president said, let me quote him. He said, "We want to thank Kim Jong-un, who really was excellent to these three incredible people." Now,
right.
The thought of what he did to, you know, the gentleman from Cincinnati and what happened to him, and to talk about how he was excellent when these people were in prison, that seems a little bit much.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the things, let me just ask this. The role of the South Korean President Moon, seems to be very important here, too. It is not just a two-way conversation that is going on here between the United States and North Korea, but South Korea seems to be playing a very critical role and very creative role in this whole process of bringing about this summit. I find that dynamic interesting and encouraging.
Well, I don't know if it began at the Olympics, but clearly that South Korea President Moon has always been talking on doing whatever he can to improve relations between the North and the South. For all the bellicosity that you hear from the North, Moon was always talking about working together and even offering aid in the past. He always was willing to offer aid if there could be some kind of a quid pro quo regarding, you know, aggression or weapons or things like that. But a lot of the demands were always, well, the U.S. needs to leave the Korean Peninsula, U.S. Forces need to leave Korea completely. And those demands are not being made now. So something is happening. It's beyond my comprehension to explain why it's happening. But if anything, I'd have to say it's good rather than bad. Even if it turns out to be a typical ruse or propaganda, whatever it is, everything I'm hearing, you have to say it's encouraging.
Right. Whatever happens in Singapore on June 12th and in these talks, I mean, it could be good. It could lead to, as Trump says, a denuclearization of the peninsula. But he has also added the caveat that if he doesn't like what he hears, he's going to walk out and leave. And if that happened, I don't know. You know, are we back square one or what?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the other thing, sort of a final point on this one, is the role that Mike Pompeo has been playing, the new Secretary of State. He seems definitely to have the support and the trust of President Trump, and he's doing the shuttlings back and forth to North Korea and laying the groundwork, and that seems to have moved forward. So there's something there as well that we should pay attention to.
Yeah, I would say the only slight criticism I would make, and of course I'm saying this with a smile, is that when Pompeo went to North Korea, he referred to President Un. He doesn't realize it's Kim Jong-un,
yeah.
And he called the president Un. So that's it's almost like a Rick Perry oops to have him on. But anyway, regardless of that, it's good to have. Look, the president needs a Secretary of State he trusts. He clearly did not have that with Rex Tillerson. Remember a few months ago when Tillerson was in Beijing trying to talk about some kind of diplomacy, President Trump was on Twitter saying, "Rex, don't waste your time. Diplomacy is not going to work." And here, just a couple of short months later, it seems to be working.
Well, I want to pick up one other, begin at least the discussion of one other foreign policy issue that took place this week, and that is our withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal. And sort of two things are particularly interesting to me. One is what the implications of this are in the Middle East. And if you take a look at what happened last night, some sort of significant exchange between Iranian forces in Syria and Israel striking back. What does this, our withdrawal, where does this leave the potential for violence in the Middle East?
Well, the thing is, in fairness to the Trump argument for why he abrogated the deal, he said that this deal did not prohibit Iran, did not keep Iran from doing its usual mischief with with, you know, subversion and terrorism and supporting terrorism. And that's true. That hasn't changed. Iran's role in the world has not changed. But to make a deal that, for including Mike Pompeo, all these leaders seem to suggest that Iran was keep living up to the bargain. And for Trump, look, obviously part of what Trump doesn't like about it is that Obama, President Obama, did it, and he seems to be determined to undo everything President Obama did. But I mean, Trump from the beginning, during the campaign, said this is the worst deal in history. I mean, it's like Yalta. It's all these awful things. And when I'm president, I'm going to end it. And that's what he did. So for all the talk about he doesn't stick with his promises, he's clearly doing it here. But there were so many people who feel that Iran has been leading up, you know, living up to the bargain, has not been enriching uranium. And what happens now is a good question, because now does this embolden the hardliners in Iran saying, well, look, if the United States can't keep its word, then why should we be restricted to what kind of, nuclear weapons we could build? So there's a lot of uncertainty. It's interesting. It seems like the only nations I've seen who support the Trump's decision are Israel and Saudi Arabia, when countries like France, Germany, and the United Kingdom say this is a big mistake.
Yeah, all of our European allies basically are saying that this is just wrong, and they're worried about it. And I don't know that there's anything they can do about it. Do you see anything?
Well, no. I mean, because look, it's never a treaty. President Obama never brought it before Congress.
Right.
Probably the reason he didn't bring it before the Senate is because it probably wouldn't have passed. It was very controversial. I mean, it's not that everybody in the Congress said, well, this is a great deal. A lot of people don't feel it. A lot of Republicans from the beginning, conservatives, said this is a big, big mistake, that what Kerry and Hillary Clinton and Obama are doing is just wrong.
Well, some Democrats, too.
The more pro-Israel Democrats, led by people like Chuck Schumer, said that trusting Iran, I don't know if we ever trusted Iran, but doing a deal with Iran was naive.
Well, one thing I do want to bring up here before we leave, because the question of our allies, people are very upset, especially in Europe. And I think the question in my mind is, how long do Macron, Merkel, Elizabeth May, how long do they continue to try to negotiate, cajole, push Trump into directions? And when do they lose faith that there's any working with the United States at this point, and they just go on without us and no longer deal with us?
I think they have to do that now. Given what President Macron said when he was here, the private negotiations he had with Trump, the address he gave to Congress, it was clear what he felt the United States should do. And it's interesting, if you want to be a conspiracy theory type person, look at what he's doing. What this has done, what Trump has done once again, is that by ending the deal with Iran, he has put more distance between us and Great Britain and France and Germany. And I mean, is this part of the Putin playbook? Look, I'm saying this partly tongue in cheek, but basically this is another division between the U.S. and its allies, and that's not good. I mean, that's not good news. Well, let me put it this way. It's not bad news for the Kremlin.
Yeah, and a lot of people in Western Europe, or leadership in Western Europe, are going to see it that way too.
Right. Now, we have several people on the line, actually quite a few, looks like five or six, who think they have an answer to Ken Rudin's trivia question. Ken, would you pose the question again, just so everybody remembers
the last person elected governor of Ohio who ran for governor, House, and Senate in his or her career?
Okay, has to have been elected.
I love when I say his or her career. I mean, there are not too many women represented Ohio in the Senate, but okay, in his career.
Or not too many women represented Ohio in the gubernatorial chair.
Right. We had a woman for 11 days, yes.
Right.
We did.
Okay.
I wish I had a woman for 11 days.
Yeah.
No, I'm sorry.
We're just moving on from that right now. Mark is on the line. Mark, you have an answer to Ken's question?
Sure do. I believe it is Ted Strickland.
Ted Strickland is a great guess. He did serve as governor. He did serve in the House, but he never ran for the Senate.
Never ran for the Senate. Okay. Well, we have somebody next. Tom, you're on the line. Do you have the answer?
I was going to say Ted Strickland also.
Well, that one's already dead. So, okay.
I think Ted Strickland's brother ran for the Senate, if memory serves. Howard would know that better than I, but not Ted Strickland, but I think his brother ran for the Senate, if that's, I think. But anyway.
Well, okay. Ted ran for Portman's seat, but that was after he was governor.
The House seat?
No, the Senate seat.
Wait a second. That's right. That was Ted Strickland. That's right.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Oh, no is right.
Ted Strickland is the correct answer.
It is.
Oh, so, God.
There was
so
another
terrible.
Correct answer, but.
Well, there can be two correct answers.
No, I didn't mean to spoil your party, but he did in 2016.
Well, okay. Now,
how about this? Could we have two winners?
And he got whipped.
We could have two winners. So, is Tom still on the line there?
Before Ted Strickland. Okay, Ted Strickland has to be. Oh, man.
Okay.
This is terrible.
This is okay. Tom will be one of our winners because of that.
Yes.
And
very good.
I believe we have. Well, first off, if Tim will call back, that will be good.
Yes.
Tim also had the right answer, so please call back 513-419-7100. We're going to go to Ralph at this point because
it's
Howard has declared okay. Howard has declared there are two answers to
it's
this.
Okay. Well, no, I mean there. Yeah. Okay.
Two correct answers.
There
Ralph,
will be today. Yes.
Ralph, do you have an answer to this question?
Well, I thought the question was who ran for and won and served in those offices, and I think it's George Voinovich.
George Voinovich never ran for the House.
Right.
He was never elected to the House. He was elected governor, and he was elected senator. This is so – can I just say something in my defense, which I really have no defense?
Yes.
But I think when you're a certain age, you forget recent stuff. You remember what happened in 1066, but I forgot what happened last election. Oh, God. Well, the worst day of my life.
Well, if this is the... So...
It's all right.
I don't know where to go here from at this point. Can we... We've got...
Well, who was the one before this?
You know what? Let's just go with the Ted Strickland answer.
Okay.
And that'll be the answer. And was it Ralph who won it?
No, I think it was...
Tim and Tom.
If Tim will call back, we're in good shape. And maybe there's another Tim, but that was another answer. And that there's only two correct answers to this particular trivia question. Okay.
Well, there's really only one.
Are we all confused enough right now? Okay.
No, I completely forgot about
that. Did John Bricker figure into this anywhere?
No. Actually, the answer I was thinking of, who was elected governor, he was elected to the House and ran for the Senate but lost.
Yeah.
Was John Gilligan.
That is very good, yes.
John Gilligan lost to ran and beat Frank Lousy, our friend Frank Lousy.
Yes, exactly.
But then he lost to Bill Saxby for the Senate.
Yeah.
And then by mentioning John Gilligan, I could say, does anybody have that LB Johnson Gilligan button that I've been looking for 100 years?
It'll
be my excuse to use it.
We're working on it.
By the way, I do want to say we had a person on the line who had thought it was John Gilligan. So, all right. We're going to move on because I don't think we should dwell on this anymore.
Let's just give away a bunch of buttons.
Pete's going to send out a lot of buttons.
Who am I thinking of now? Okay, right. Okay.
All right.
I apologize.
Okay, well, it's good to know that even the political junkie sometimes doesn't get it right. Okay, let's talk about the primaries that took place on Tuesday. Ohio was one of those states. But before we talk about Ohio, there were some interesting races that I think may point to some trends or not. Who knows? We'll have to wait and see. But Ken, in North Carolina, Robert Pittenger lost. He was an incumbent, and he lost to a Tea Party-backed candidate, Mark Harris.
He lost to Ted Strickland.
So how much do you want to read into that particular election?
Well, there are a lot of really, really interesting things that happened on Tuesday. One of them in the North Carolina, first of all, Robert Pittenger is so far, we've only had six primaries so far, the four on Tuesday, then Texas and Illinois in March. But he's the first incumbent member of Congress, you know, the House or senator, who has been defeated. He was defeated. Now, he was conservative, but he moved way to the right to deal with this with Mark Harris, who's a Charlotte pastor who's very, very, very conservative. But he felt that for him to win the primary, he had to move way to the right. By doing so, he wasn't, first of all, he wasn't seen as sufficiently conservative. But now Mark Harris is so far to the right that the Democrats think they can take this seat because the Republicans have just moved way away from the center. And that is a fear that a lot of Republicans have around the country, that if they're being challenged by the right, from the right, during the primaries, all the years they've spent trying to, you know, foster goodwill with centrists and Democrats and things like that may go out the window, if especially if there's an anti-Republican tide trend in November. Then, you know, then you have somebody who's more moderate who can come on and win the seat. So that was an interesting thing that Pittenger, even though he moved way to the right, it wasn't conservative enough and he lost the primary.
And he'll now face Dan McCready as the Democratic
right. And he won his primary handily. And, you know, the differences between D's and R's in that district are not gigantic. And so even though North Carolina has been vastly redistricted, redrawn by the Republican legislature, this is a seat that the Democrats are feeling more and more good about.
Yeah, and I think there's going to be a whole lot more seats like that with that very same dynamic with these guys being
people
pushed,
moving to the, being pushed to the
pushed
right.
To the right.
Yeah. So how about in
even here,
in West Virginia –
yeah.
I'm not sure they could have gotten much farther to the right, but Don mm-hmm. Blankenship came in third in a three-way race, and President Trump came out the weekend before the election, last weekend, and said, don't vote for this guy. He's going to lose the seat in November. So what do you read into that one?
And not only did he say, don't vote for Blankenship, he said, remember Alabama. And obviously that was a reference to Roy Moore, the very controversial Republican who basically was responsible for the Republicans losing the Senate seat in Alabama, the old Jeff Sessions Senate seat. So, but for Trump to say that, given the fact that he backed Roy Moore all the way, was interesting. Somebody got to him, I don't know if it was Mitch McConnell or the party establishment, whatever that means, but clearly the Republicans feel that Joe Manchin, the senator from West Virginia, is vulnerable. It's a state that Donald Trump beat Hillary Clinton by 42 points. I mean, this was a huge, huge Trump state. He's very, very, the president remains very popular in the mountain state, and they feel that Joe Manchin is vulnerable, but not with Blankenship, who had been a coal executive whose mine exploded in, I think, 2010. 29 miners were killed, and he went to prison for a year for, I think it was a misdemeanor charge, but he went to prison for a year for violations that led to the explosion in the mine. So not only is he an ex-convict, but he also is a deadly dull campaigner. He talks in a monotone, and he's really not charismatic at all, and he had these very bizarre commercials on TV talking about Cocaine Mitch, obviously referring to Mitch McConnell. And if you read articles, you found out that Mitch McConnell's father-in-law, who's Chinese, owned a shipping line that maybe cocaine was found on the ship. It was just so bizarre because there was no context for Blankenship to go on the air talking about Cocaine Mitch. And then he talked about Mitch McConnell's family being Chinese people.
China person.
Yeah. And that's just, I mean, my goodness.
I mean, there was only one way that that the Republicans could blow this Manchin thing, and that was by nominating Blankenship. I mean, he would have been a disaster. absolute
disaster.
Yeah,
I'm not convinced they're going to win it anyway. Yeah, Patrick Morrissey, who's a state attorney general, is not the greatest candidate.
No, no.
He's from New Jersey. He's a former lobbyist. He ran for Congress in New Jersey.
But he doesn't have all this baggage, though.
No, he has a lot of pharmaceutical backing behind him, but that's an issue in many states around the country.
True.
But he doesn't have what Blankenship had, that's for sure.
Let's shift our attention now to Ohio. One of the primaries are funny to read. Only 21% of the people, registered voters, turned out statewide. But do you see any indications of a blue wave of a big Democratic surge in Ohio? Let's start with Howard this time.
Well, I don't see anything like a tsunami, anything a big wave. Maybe there's some kind of wave out there. They're still going to be outspent by enormous amounts of money by the Republican Party and the Republican statewide candidates. You still have a state where Donald Trump won by 8 percentage points, and somebody's got to win those votes over. Mike DeWine, during the primary, tried to keep pretty much an arm's length away from Trump. Mary Taylor, embraced him like you wouldn't believe. I mean, there was a TV ad that said, Trump and Taylor are going to build the wall. Now, I don't know what wall the governor of Ohio can build. I don't know if it's between Pennsylvania and Ohio or Pennsylvania or Ohio and Indiana. But
are we building a wall rather than a bridge between
Ohio
and Kentucky?
But this it's kind of hard to imagine a blue wave in Ohio right now with the electorate split the way it is. I think it's going to be a close one. I really do, with Cordray and with Mike DeWine, because they both have a lot of experience. They both have a lot of savvy, and they're going to have all the resources that they need.
Ken, what did you see, and especially in that gubernatorial race, and with Cordray on the one side and DeWine on the other emerging?
Well, several things. First of all, I know the Republicans have to be encouraged by the fact that 147,000 more ballots were cast in the Republican primary than the Democratic primary, and I thought that was a surprise. That's a lot more than I expected. But I also expected the primary between Richard Cordray and Dennis Kucinich to be close, and it was a landslide. It was a slaughter. It was like 3-1. It was like he won by 40 percentage points, Cordray did. And you know, you say, well, the liberals back Cordray, even though Elizabeth Warren likes him? What about his former backing from the gun lobbies and the NRA and things like that? But apparently Democrats didn't care about that. They certainly rewarded him with a huge victory in the primary. Kucinich, maybe because he's somehow become a Trump supporter. It's very weird what's happened to Dennis Kucinich. But yes, it wasn't close, and I thought it would be. On the Republican side, I mean, the thought of watching Mary Taylor campaign calling Mike DeWine too liberal for Ohio, I mean, has the Republican Party moved that far to the right that Mike DeWine is too liberal for Ohio? I thought that was very, very bizarre. Also, when I saw Mike DeWine calling Richard Cordray a career politician when Mike DeWine has been running since 1066, I don't understand what that's all about. But also what's interesting, too, is that there's a strange dynamic about Trump and Ohio and Kasich and Ohio. And I don't know how popular Kasich is among regular Republicans anymore, given the fact that he's such a strong Trump critic. But there seems to be this weird dance whether DeWine wants Kasich's endorsement. I think he does, but does he want it right away? Does Kasich want to give him the endorsement? So if the Republican Party is not united going into November, that's going to be a disaster. I still think, as Howard says, my gut tells me DeWine wins, but I think the Democrats got a lot of encouraging things that happened on Tuesday a tsunami. I don't know about a Democratic wave. Certainly in Ohio, I don't see evidence of it. Certainly not in the House when so many of the districts are preordained. But I thought the Teaberry district around Columbus was interesting in the fact that the establishment guy, the one backed by Teaberry, barely beat this conservative woman who is backed by Jim Jordan and the Freedom Caucus, and Republicans were scared to death that this woman, Melanie Lenigan, is that who it was?
Yeah.
Was going to win the primary, then lose the seat to the Democrats. But clearly the Republicans are split there between the establishment and the Freedom Caucus. And again, like we saw in North Carolina, if the Republican Party's two wings, you know, if the two wings, I hang up, but if the two wings don't get together, get their act together in time for November, it doesn't have to be a tsunami. It could be like, it just could help the Democrats eke out victories in many districts.
Mary Taylor spent all of this time and all of this money attacking Mike DeWine, you know, his D.C. DeWine and career politician and a guy who wouldn't even show up at Trump rallies in Ohio and didn't support the president. None of this is going to matter. You can't in a general election, obviously, Rich Cordray is not going to attack Mike DeWine for being too liberal. You know, these are arguments that are primary.
The dynamic completely changed.
Right. These are primary election arguments, and I don't think they're, you know, the so-called split in the Republican Party, I don't think is that great.
So one question before we take a break. What's the future for Mary Taylor? Does she have a future?
Well, yeah, I think she does. I mean, she can be a really, you know, attractive candidate, you know, a good candidate, maybe, you know, for a House seat or somewhere down the line, another one of the down-ticket statewide
offices.
Yeah. But I don't think she did herself any favors with this.
We do have a caller who's called in, and I want to make sure that we get to that before we get involved in some other issues that we were going to bring up. So, Susan,
is this for the trivia question?
No, this is not the trivia. Let's just forget
the
trivia.
Have we done that yet?
Let's move on.
No, we didn't do it today.
Okay, let's move on. Okay. Susan, you're on the line. Do you have a question, please?
Yes, I'm on the line. This is Susan, and I'd like to say that, first of all, that this is my favorite Cincinnati edition when you have the political junkie on, and I am a sustaining member. But my question was, well, I had two questions. My first question was, with the wonderful news last night about these three Koreans being released and how, you know, that personally affects us in Cincinnati with the death of Otto Warmbier, how do you think that helps President Trump in his decision to pull out of the Iran deal also?
Okay, so the question, I think, is the political implications of the North Korean situation and also pulling out of the Iranian deal. Ken?
Well, you know, it's a difficult question because on the face of it, they shouldn't be linked, but they are linked because how do you go to the North Koreans and say, I want to work out a deal with you when you know, people will say, well, what about the U.S.'s word when it came to the Iranian deal? Now, Trump will say, well, that was an Obama deal and not my deal. My deals, you can take to the bank. But so it's kind of confusing. Look, the president did mention Otto's name this morning when the three Korean Americans were released. So I don't see the president certainly not forgetting this at all. But I just thought, given the horrific treatment, what happened to that Cincinnati man before he was released and ultimately died, and to say how happy he was with Kim Jong-un's excellent treatment of the current batch, it just gets the feeling, it just feels that President Trump, if there's some good news, if either somebody likes him or somebody says something nice about him or there's something, some kind of news that benefits him, he just seems to put reality or at least everything else behind him and see only the good side of it. If it wasn't going, for example, if Kim Jong-un said something critical, I suspect Donald Trump would say something inflammatory and insulting again and talk about bombs. But as long as people are reaching out to him, he seems to be reaching out in response. And I don't think he sees any contradiction in different kinds of behavior.
Yeah, he very much likes the kind of talk, you know, when people say, he needs to be nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize and this sort of thing.
Kanye West. Explain Kanye West to me.
I don't
he know. Loves Kanye West now.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you're right.
Well, I think it's to get back to the question itself. I do think you can see a growth of support in the polls President Trump.
Right.
And I think some of these foreign policy things probably are the explanation for that.
That accounts for it, for most of it. I mean, it's not a huge jump, but it's a jump. And he's probably at the highest approval rating that he's been at, so far in his presidency. And there's only one thing to account for that, and that's, this North Korean situation.
Okay. Well, we've got another caller, and Bob's on the line. And Bob, you're picking up, you're going back to our discussion about the gubernatorial primary. I want to pick that up before we move on. So what is your question?
Yes. Well, regarding any of the Republican primaries races, is there any indication that the high Republican turnout was due to Democrats crossing over and attempting to throw support toward Republican candidates that are of a more extreme persuasion and would not be electable in the fall?
I absolutely don't think so. I mean, I don't think that's the case at all. It's really hard for me, having covered politics in Ohio for over 40 years, which is how long Mike DeWine's been in politics, to think of him as an extremist.
Yeah. I would also point out that looking just at Hamilton County,
right,
for the first time, at least since 2002, I haven't looked at the data before that. For the first time, there were more people turned out and selected the Democratic ballot than the Republican ballot. Now, that indicates demographic change.
Right. Yes.
So I think that actually works against, Bob, what you were suggesting, that there was a crossover of Democrats to Republicans.
And, Bob, I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that there was just a whole lot more noise on the Republican side. In terms of the millions and millions and millions of dollars of TV advertising and that sort of thing, which you didn't see on the Democratic side.
Let me get to a couple of other things. And one of them, yesterday, Gina Haspel was in front of a Senate committee, and a lot of hard questions. Senator John McCain, who was not there, who is ill and is in Arizona, he issued a statement saying that he would not vote for Gina Haspel. He's made himself very clear about what he thinks about U.S. policy during the Iraq War and what he sees as torture of prisoners. So what do you think is Gina Haspel going to survive this process? Is she going to make it through as a nominee? Ken?
Haspel, yeah, I think she is. I think she will. Joe Manchin is a Democrat who just announced the other day that he will vote for her confirmation as the head of the CIA. I think it's very interesting, and it probably should be more reported than it has been, because the fact is that many former CIA directors and officers who served under both Democrats and Republicans say great things about her. They say that she's the most qualified person ever to be head of the CIA. She'd be the right person. She knows the agency inside and out, and she'd be the right person. Others say, if you listen to Dianne Feinstein and Kamala Harris and other Democrats in the Senate, say, wait a second, she worked on, waterboarding and torture, which is anathema to, decency in this country. So there was a big debate, and it's interesting, she was grilled by the senators, Gina Haspel, but I don't think she gave a straight answer towards almost anything. She was asked over and over again whether she feels that waterboarding was immoral, and she wouldn't answer that question at all. She would say that, well, first of all, we're not going to bring it back. We promised not to bring it back. And in the past, we just did what the guidelines said we should. So There's a past in this country about foreign policy and the way we've treated detainees and suspected terrorists in the past that should be a blot on our collective memory. But it seems like that she still may be confirmed anyway, even though John McCain says please don't vote for her. Of course, John McCain did go through terrible, terrible torture when he was in North Vietnam in the 1970s, and you know, nobody has a stronger sense of right and wrong when it comes to torture than he.
I would suggest this isn't just about the past, because during the campaign, President Trump said that he was open to using torture as a means of suppressing what he would call terrorism, and that it would make what we did in Iraq look like child's play. So I think the fear is that she would not stand up to that. I think that's more – it's the future is as much at issue here as the past.
Yeah, but I agree. She did say during the testimony that she would reject and ignore any order by the president to reinstitute that kind of torture. Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, who was her predecessor as CIA director, said absolutely not. Torture is no longer a possibility in this administration, even though, as you say, Donald Trump talked about it during the campaign. But both Pompeo and Haspel said absolutely not.
Howard, any one of
the thing that John McCain said was that he sees her as perfectly competent, a highly intelligent, very capable person, but that he just cannot get past her role in this torture during the Iraq war, and you know that's something that John McCain cannot take.
Well, let's move on to another issue that is making headlines every day, and that's Michael Cohen, the president's personal attorney, fixer. And what has now been revealed is that the payment to porn star Stormy Daniels came from a company that was also taking in millions of dollars to Michael Cohen to be a consultant to help companies, organizations, and someone close to a Russian oligarch figure out how to manage and how to maneuver inside the Trump administration. This seems to me it merges the Stormy Daniels thing with the Mueller investigation directly.
Oh, I agree completely. I mean, not only Stormy Daniels and Russia, the fact that, I mean, first of all, it started out with Rudy Giuliani going on Hannity last week and saying, oh, yeah, the president paid him back. And, of course, the president had denied that. Michael Cohen had denied that. And suddenly Rudy Giuliani, who thinks that everything he says, you know, people should just listen to everything he says because he's Rudy Giuliani. He said it, and then everybody in the White House said, oh, no, why are you saying this? And Sarah Sanders, who, it's hard to feel sorry for her, but Sarah Sanders was completely flummoxed and said, well, this is news to me, or this didn't happen. But the thing with Cohen, with this shell company that he got the money from, and with ties to Russia, I mean, this is basically exactly what Mueller is talking about. And that's why, given the precarious position that Cohen is in, I found it very interesting that the president would throw him under the bus, as they like to say. Giuliani said he's no longer his attorney, the president's attorney. The president said when he spoke to Fox and Friends that really I don't have that much much to do with Michael Cohen. I have a lot of lawyers, and I would have thought that given the fact that Mueller is going to obviously put pressure on Cohen to talk, the president would have been more solicitous or more careful of what he said about Cohen, because everything I read about Cohen, he seems like a very fragile kind of person, that he needs the love of Donald Trump. And if he feels betrayed, I think the president may be taking a risk. But I think there's a big story there, and I don't know ultimately what it all is saying, but it just seems like it's something that is not going to go away anytime soon.
No, it's bad. It's very bad. I mean, if Michael Cohen starts talking, and he won't shut up.
Yeah. Well,
that's true about Rudy Giuliani. He talking, I mean, he doesn't shut up either.
Right. Yeah. I don't know whose idea that was, but yeah.
Well, I think
Rudy's.
We know
I think it was Rudy's.
Yeah.
Oh, I think it was.
Yeah.
I think it was the president's idea, thinking bringing in somebody who was strong.
Well, yeah.
But really backfired very quickly.
Yeah. Do you want Rudy Giuliani saying the president may take the Fifth Amendment, given all the things that Trump has said about the Fifth Amendment, that it's only for mobsters, it's only for the criminals, it's only for Hillary, and then the president could take the Fifth Amendment, according to Rudy Giuliani? Every time he says something, he says, don't say that.
I've got one more issue that I want to get on the table before we run out of time, and that is the announcement that Melania Trump made this week about what her priorities were. And, once again, she announced a program that used and sort of put out a document that has already existed. I see this as terrible staff work, that she is just not being supported by people who are good at what they're doing. I feel really this is a terrible situation she's been put in.
Yeah, that would not happen in any recent White House that I'm aware of. I mean, they have, staff people for the First Lady, who are competent and can handle this kind of thing. But clearly that's not the case here.
Yeah, it's just.
Yeah, I mean, remember during her convention speech, everybody said that it was cribbed from something else, from somebody else. And you knew that was true because when she stood up there and said, I love my husband, Barack Obama, you knew that she was taking it from somebody else. So, I agree with you. I'm not criticizing her. I don't think she asked for this job. I think she is not being served well.
No.
Well, anyway, want to thank both Ken and Howard. And Ken, next month when you come back, let's really research that trivia question so that we're not just trying to trip Howard.
Yeah. So, anyway. No, that was a first. It will never happen.
It'll never happen again. This has been great. Right. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our program are available on the website at wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley. Stay tuned to 91.7 for Here and Now, coming up next.